How do you do, fellow kids?
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley and joining me this week is Terry DeFellon.
Hello.
How are you doing, Terry?
I'm very well, thank you, Graham. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, it's been quite a week, isn't it, really? It's been a busy week for us, isn't it, at Stately Sound of Football Manor. Usually we record on a Monday night, and then I edit the podcast on a Tuesday and then it goes out early Tuesday evening, and usually it's quite a smooth process. But I must admit, Terry, last week, Tuesday wasn't the easiest day for me editing that podcast. I put it out pretty much as was, but yeah, should we say that the story unfolded quite a bit? Tuesday was quite a day, wasn't it?
Yeah, I imagine Tuesday was quite a day for you because, yes, again, you're the poor schmuck who has to edit the podcast down. But I spent an awful lot of time looking at the doing and thinking, we kind of said that this might happen in the podcast. Yeah, we kind of said that this might happen in the podcast. We kind of said that that might happen in the podcast as well. So I was feeling quite pleased with myself and quite pleased with ourselves because I thought that, although we don't make predictions on the Sound of Football podcast, but I think that we were spiritually and philosophically in the right place when it came to how events unfolded the following day. But I certainly didn't anticipate that this would fall to pieces as quickly as it did.
No, it really was on fast forward as far as collapsing is concerned. Really, within 24 hours, the whole thing was done and dusted.
It almost started falling apart, I think, that evening as well. I mean, it was just extraordinary how probably the most visual aspect was the protest prior to the Chelsea game and just how angry people were and the fact that you had all these young men out there getting angry and exactly the same demographic who apparently, according to Fiorentina Perez, are the ones who are walking away from live football because it's too long and too boring. It was quite surprising to see that. I was quite taken aback by the level and commitment of the protests against this. It surprised me to a certain degree. I've constructed for myself a vision of football fans as being a little bit more sedentary than that, more tolerant of changes like this. And I knew it was an unpopular thing, but I didn't realise that English football fans still had it in them to be so vociferous and mobilised so well. You know, I'm obviously delighted with the outcome.
Well, certainly. I was somewhat surprised as well by the fact that all the fan groups seemed to move as one on this one. And there was no sort of fracturing or splintering of fan groups, which there usually is. There is usually some kind of schism between fan groups on things like ownership and management and things like that. So that really did surprise me, that it seemed to be one direction and that was completely against it. But I did get the feeling, though, that everyone was against it, but they weren't really against the idea that was there. They were against an idea that was growing, that it wasn't the ESL per se, although they were against that, but it was more about the direction in which football was going and about how everything was changing and everything was basically out of their control. And of course, it's been lovely since because they've been the ones made to feel as if they were the winners. They were the ones that did this. But as well, we have to remember that there was almost a complete opposition for this within the media. And this was what united everyone as well, was the fact that everyone in the media seemed to be against that. Now, whether that's just the media just reflecting what they feel the public would think of this idea, or whether or not it was just a question of, actually, this is no good for us, we'll actually stand against this. What was your opinion on how the reporting of this whole thing went?
Well, I think they probably would have had some advanced knowledge of the announcement, even prior to the advanced knowledge that the rest of us had. Say, we sort of like got wind of this in, what was it, Saturday? I think last Saturday was we knew the announcement was coming. And I suspect that probably the broadcasters might have heard about this even earlier, because obviously, you know, these things would have travelled along the news wires a little bit quicker. For me, the response, particularly the one that I probably followed the most, I think like most people, was Sky Sports' response. For me, that seemed very vociferously opposed, a clear editorial line, and not rehearsed, but certainly they were prepared for this. Gary Neville's remarks and his opinions that he expressed in the afternoon on Sunday very, very clear. I think that he knew perfectly well what was that this was coming, and he had his takes ready. And I think that the producers and the director, and I think that everyone was very clear about this was the editorial line that we were going to take. And almost, I don't believe there was a single dissenting voice in favour of the Super League on Sky Sports. It was a very, very clear message, and which tells you something, I think, because it suggests that Sky, in theory at least, had no involvement whatsoever in discussions with the European Super League, as was, about possibly partnering up as a broadcaster, because you might expect that if they had, that they would have been a little bit more circumspect in their reaction to it. But and this was the case across the board. I mean, the other significant player was, of course, BT, who were also massively opposed to it and said so as well on their broadcasts. And this is the surprising element. You would think if you were putting together a European Super League, is that you would, especially when six of the clubs in this league are going to be from England, that you would talk to the English broadcasters, at least have informal discussions, you know, invite them around for lunch or something like that, just to discuss the idea and say, this is what we're doing. It's odd that that doesn't appear to have happened.
That is the most surprising thing, that there doesn't seem to have been, at least publicly, a broadcaster lined up for this. The whole thing struck me as just a completely mismanaged affair from the start. There just didn't seem to be that level of management that you would expect for something this high profile. When the Premier League was established back in 1992, Sky was owned by News Corp. It was part of the Murdoch empire that had the Sun and the Times on board instantly. When that was announced, there was fanfare. All there was fanfare. Yes, there was protest, but that was drowned out by Murdoch making money.
If you remember, Graham, when it was announced, no broadcast partner was brought with them. That was all subject to a bid. But the key difference being is that the FA Premier League was an FA-sanctioned league and was going to happen because the FA said it was going to happen. In that respect, it wasn't a breakaway. It wasn't breaking away from the FA, it was just breaking away from the Football League. And so the expectation would have been that we could go into a fair and just bidding cycle with ITV, BBC and indeed Sky B, who ended up winning it thanks to a phone call from Alan Sugar. That's Tottenham chairman and Amstrad satellite dish manufacturer Alan Sugar. Anyway, that's ancient history. So it's a slightly different situation here. Is it possible that they looked at the Premier League when they formed the Premier League and went, oh, well, it's fine, we'll just do the same again. We won't talk to any broadcast partners because they'll come flooding to us when they realise that it's going to be happening. They say all this stuff now, but once we get things going and up and running, they'll come banging on our door, no problem. I think certainly in the modern media landscape, that is just not something that you do. They'll speak to at least one or two broadcasters and say, look, what do you think of the idea? Is it something that you'd be interested in? And then, you know, just to get some kind of indication as to at least how much money you're likely to make, as to whether this is a good idea. And also, it's been suggested to me by an industry insider that it's very unlikely that they would have got any kind of underwriting agreement from JP Morgan if they didn't have certain assurances that they had broadcast partners lined up.
You said last week that there would be no way back for this if this fails, and it failed even more spectacularly than we predicted last week. We said it would collapse by the end of the week. We didn't realise that it would collapse by the following day, before lunchtime of the following day. They've lost all their positions of power now. Agnelli is no longer the chairman of the ECA. He's been replaced by someone from PSG. In the short term, there's been a massive power shift in Europe. UEFA just announced their restructure of the Champions League. Now, there are calls that the people that they negotiated that with did so in bad faith, so they've got no reason to go ahead with that restructuring. What do you think the near future is going to hold for the people in positions of power in Europe at the moment?
I believe it will be, as I said last week, is that if this doesn't work, they'll have alienated so many different people in power that they'll just end up losing their influence and losing their power base. Well, they won't be ignored because they're still big clubs. But no one's going to take them seriously if they've got any ideas. The next time we come up for the Premier League comes up for its negotiations about how the TV money is divvied up amongst the clubs. I mean, in previous years, they've argued successfully that they're the big clubs and so therefore they should get a greater share of the cash, even though it's supposed to be by collective bargaining. any attempt now to push that forward and get more money, they're just going to get told to get stuffed by the other clubs, and because they're traitors and they'll be seen as such. Obviously, also, yes, as you pointed out, it's Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who is now the chairman of the ESA. He's also on the board of UEFA. He's also got big ties with beIN Sports, who I think, if you remember Sound of Football's passing, we talked about the difficulties that beIN Sports have had. It's all looking really, really good for that power group now. And it means that, yeah, like Real Madrid, Barcelona, and the English Premier League clubs and the Italian Serie A, they are very much out of the equation now. They're not going to be able to make any or be involved in any big decision-making because of this. So if there is going to be another attempt at a European Super League, it's going to be led by Al-Khelaifi and others in that group, if assuming, of course, that they show sufficient lack of wisdom to attempt such a caper again, because I would think that they would certainly not. This is it for the European Super League. I said it last week, yeah. And I really do believe it. We're not kicking the can down the road. This has been defeated for at least a generation, I think.
There is a lot of people that feel that it's just going to come back in a different form. I think something big would have to change for that to happen. I think that might need a change at the top of UEFA for that to happen. I don't think Seferin's actually going anywhere now. I think he's feeling very, very empowered by what's happened this week. And I think a lot of people are. Obviously, a lot of people are angry at the so-called Dirty Dozen, and there has been widespread calls for sanctions against them. But what do you think the wisdom is of sanctions against these clubs, and how successful do you think they will be? Do you think that these clubs need sanctions against them to make sure that they don't do it again?
Instinctively, I feel that they should be all relegated, or they should start the next season with a minus 100 points, and they should be banned from the Champions League. But the reality of that is, going back to what we were talking about last week, is if you relegate your most successful clubs from your league, then you devalue your league.
Yeah.
And when I say successful, can I just revise that? If you don't allow the most popular clubs into your league, then you devalue your league. And if there are certain financial undertakings made to broadcasters, so let's say, for example, you say to BT Sport, we're not allowing Liverpool or Manchester United into the Champions League next season as punishment, then BT will go, well, hang on, where are our TV viewers going to come from? And, you know, we pay you lots and lots of money so that these clubs can pay on our channel. Why are you doing that? I mean, you only need to just like go back to when Leicester qualified for the Champions League after winning the title. It's rumoured that there were broadcasters from other countries who are not quite as close to English football asking, one, who were Leicester City, and two, could they be replaced by another club? This is the world in which they live. I really think that that's unlikely. I mean, I think it's certainly the right thing to do, but unfortunately, it's just simply not realistic to do that. And the same goes with the Premier League. I mean, like, well, would you kick Liverpool out of the Premier League? I mean, that's ridiculous. Reducing them to pariah status is one thing. The other element to consider, of course, is that it is the effect that it would have. You talked earlier about, Graham, about fan unity. Just consider what that would then do with a united fan base, a currently united fan base, who would then start to splinter if it was felt that their clubs were being treated too harshly. I think that they've reined back on this so quickly after the announcement. They've dialed, wound their necks back in so quickly that they've managed to, in their own minds at least, they feel they've escaped any kind of moral requirement for punishment, that they've learned their lesson and they won't do it again. And indeed, in the long term, they have been punished. I mean, you know, Real Madrid and Barcelona are in deep trouble now because of the scale of the debts they're getting. If Perez is being serious about what he's been saying, and, you know, replace the words football with the words Real Madrid, and you'll get an idea of just how bad a state his club is in. You know, we could be talking about, you know, seismic changes within Spanish football as the Spanish giants collapse. Maybe not go out and disappear out of La Liga, but become also Rans. It's worth thinking about.
There is always the thought, though, that Real Madrid are too big to fail and something will somehow rescue them. But looking at those numbers, it's very difficult to see how. Of course, if you want to have a look at an example of when a league takes sanctions against one of its most popular teams, you've only got to look to when Rangers were demoted to the very bottom of the Scottish League. They were done so by the clubs within the league, pretty much unanimous. But the damage that that did to Scottish football set it back. Well, the clubs are still paying for it now. The deal that Sky and BT had for Scottish football, when the announcement was made that Rangers would be demoted, hadn't been signed, and it was thought to be worth £80 million. Once Rangers got demoted, Sky just went in with a red pen and pretty much almost halved that TV deal. That went down from 80 to 50. That meant that clubs in Scotland had to find an extra £1 million that they thought they were going to have. And that actually put many of them very close to collapse afterwards. It's very well all saying, no, no, let's just damage them. Let's kick them out. Let's give them European bans. Let's demote them. Let's give them huge points bans. But the truth is, the broadcasters don't want this. And while we as fans might want it, it just isn't going to happen because it devalues the product so much.
First of all, the Scottish Premier League did the right thing by demoting Rangers, because the Rangers weren't effectively, they were a brand new club.
Yeah.
And that is what you should do. In England, if something like that happens, they go all the way back down to what, step 8 or 9 in non-league, don't they? Yeah. And then have to find their way all the way back up to the top again. So from a sporting point of view, what they did was absolutely right. But the lessons about that aren't, don't relegate your big clubs because, you know, you're going to lose TV money. The lesson of that is run and own your clubs in such a way as to protect you from these kinds of changes and these kinds of problems that can occur so that you're not so dependent on TV money in order to survive. And that is, of course, a much, much harder thing to do and to organise. That is the way to resolve this issue. When I say that they can't sanction clubs because, you know, of the effect that it's going to have on the broadcasters and because of the potential revenue that will be lost by broadcast deals, I don't say this because it's a good thing. That's a terrible thing. That's not how football should be run. Football should be able to protect itself better from that. But it is the reality, and I think that, you know, we have to acknowledge the current reality.
One of the good things that's come out of this whole sorry mess is it has kickstarted the conversation about how football clubs are owned and run. One of the most headline-grabbing ideas is imposing the German model of club ownership here in the UK, and that is introducing the 50-plus-1 rule. Now, Terry, obviously you've been immersed in German football for well over a decade now, so you're very comfortable with the workings of the 50-plus-1 rule. Now, we have to be careful before we start this because, obviously, Barcelona and Real Madrid are 100% fan-owned. They are fan-owned clubs. They are not owned by oligarchs. They are owned by the fans. Florentino Perez is elected into his role. That's his position, and he's pretty much rock solid in that position because everyone in Real Madrid seems to love him for the fact that he spends lots and lots and lots of money that he doesn't have. So, Terry, how is the 50-plus-1 rule actually going to work in England? Can it work in England? And will it improve anything?
I'm not necessarily in favour of a 50-plus-1 rule for English football, even though I've advocated it for a long time. And that is quite simply because I'm not entirely certain that the English football would bring in the governance and controls on spending regulations that are also applying in German football that make it harder, it has to be said, for German football clubs to often compete, particularly on the European level, because they have these kinds of restrictions that prevent them from raising the kind of capital that they would want to. This, I think, is the issue with 50-plus-1. I don't know whether English football would really work like that. The odd thing is, Graham, is that there is a feeling that 50-plus-1 is on its way out in Germany, amongst some people in Germany, I think. Not that that's a desirable thing, but there is a feeling that there's a sort of commercial imperative. And this is in part because Bayern Munich have just become so powerful and so rich and so far away that nobody really feels that unless you bring in somebody who's able to compete with their spending to bring them up to their level, that they're just never going to ever lose another Bundesliga title. I think that's perhaps an exaggeration. There's also the argument that RB Leipzig and TSG Hoffenheim have circumvented the 50-plus-1 rule to the point where it's effectively rendered it ineffective. And I think that that is significant. I think at some point we will presumably see RB Leipzig winning a major trophy, possibly actually winning the Champions League before they win the Bundesliga, ironically, or maybe the Europa League. There's a feeling actually that it may be, not that it's had its day, it's still extremely popular, but there I think that people can foresee a future without 50-plus-1. Now, the European Super League farrago may well have actually set that thinking back a while. I think that maybe everyone's kind of stopped for a moment and thought, well, no, actually, maybe we are able to do that. But let's just pause for a moment, right? 50 plus one exists, and for the clubs that use it well, it does okay. But like the reason why Bayern Munich are so successful is because of like all that extra money that they're getting in from their other sponsors that they're able to make work by utilizing the 50 plus one rule and still being able to bring in lots and lots of money from sponsors who don't buy stakes in the club. And that's how it sort of like works. But not all other clubs can do that. And also look at Schalke, who have been relegated. Look at, we'll give you an example of that. When Ralf Rangnick went to Schalke to look at whether or not he would take over as sporting director of Schalke, he said that there were innumerous imponderables about the club, and he didn't really know who was responsible for what. Now, one could make the argument that this is as a result of an ownership structure that allows for that kind of bad ownership and for things to go wrong, and that maybe there's some wisdom in having a much, much smaller ownership model that circumvents those problems. Ditto Hamburg as well. The argument against that easily is to say, well, look, hang on, Terry, those are just clubs that are badly run. It didn't matter what the ownership model is. They're just badly run football clubs. And there may be something in that. But I think it is worth highlighting those examples. It is not a panacea, I think, 50 plus one. And I think that we should be careful over here before we embrace it fully.
I'd add to that list as well clubs like Hannover and Nuremberg as well. They're two big clubs that are basically basket cases.
Absolutely.
And cannot get themselves out of the second tier.
And in Hannover's case, because Martin Kind wants actually to take full ownership of the club, but isn't being allowed to, and so is effectively not interested in funding the club anymore. And in the case of Nuremberg, is a very similar case to Schalke, is that there's so many different competing interests within that football club that no one can get a decision made. No one is able to get together a coalition. Clemens Tönnies was the president of Schalke, and he was able to keep that club going. Then when it transpired he was a hideous racist and he had to resign, that club has fallen apart because its various factions that he previously had got under control have consumed the club. And these are the things you have to be careful about with 50 plus one. And the bigger the club, but the more susceptible you will be to those kind of problems. I mean, I think certainly you think about clubs like Manchester United, I would imagine that there's an awful lot of different departments and silos within that club. And it requires strong leadership to be able to get them all together and working in the same direction. And we'll have no experience of doing it like that over here. You know, that's not our tradition. So it's something that we should think very carefully about before embracing. I think it's a great thing. I think it is a good thing.
Yeah.
But I just think we need to be careful, that's all.
Yeah, but it's also a rule that they can't enforce in Germany either, because two teams that are perhaps not the most spectacular sides, they don't win a lot, but they are regularly top half, are Wolfsburg and Leverkusen. And
yeah.
They're never really in any danger of going down. But of course, they are owned by huge corporations.
Yeah. This is true. I mean, I think that it's a little bit unkind to suggest that they can't enforce them, because that is done by convention, because they have always been there. They are effectively works clubs. The thing that annoys me about both of those clubs is that their positions is inflated by the money that they get. You know, if they were left to their own devices, they would be Greenhouse clubs, and at the best, they would be mid-table Bundesliga and actually possibly conceivably second division football clubs. But they get extra money, which elevates their status, where they could be playing. Certainly, Wolfsburg could be playing in the Champions League next season, and Leverkusen are regular Champions League contenders. And on the basis of their fan base and the money that comes in, I don't really feel that, you know, that's the best spirit. I think that shouldn't be there. But I don't have any problem with that ownership model. Bayer Leverkusen, you know, it's like a nice, cosy works club. It's like a nice little amenity that the employer has set up for the people who live and work in Leverkusen and work for the Bayer Corporation. It's a nice amenity. It's just, I don't know whether or not they should be playing Champions League football and competing for titles. Well, I mean, they don't. They generously appoint basket case managers and they're absolutely comedic. But I mean, you know, I think you get my drift.
Just to put the whole Schalke situation into perspective, they've just been relegated. They are the third richest club in the Bundesliga. On the most recent Deloitte's table, they were 16th. There's only four German teams in that top 20. the other one, apart from Bayern and Dortmund, is Frankfurt, which comes in at 20. So just to put that into perspective, Schalke sit just below Inter and Zenit St. Petersburg and above Everton and Lyon. They have been truly horrendous this season, haven't they?
They could have been invited into the European Super League, Schalke.
Yeah.
Given how popular a football club they are.
And they would have bitten their hand off as well for it, I think. but yes, we can look forward to them playing Hamburg next season, though, because Hamburg certainly aren't going up anytime soon, are they?
No.
Okay, well, here's another thing that we brushed on last week. What Florentino Perez said as to one of the main reasons why the ESL needed to happen. And that's because he's looking ahead into the future. He's trying to protect football and protect football's future because of changing demographics and the younger people, you know, the younger people, they don't want football as it is. They want, you know, hip football. They want football that they can consume and share on their TikToks and Snapchats and help me out here, Terry.
No, you're doing beautifully. Don't let me stop you. Yeah, I think that might be getting the wrong end of the stick there, mightn't it? I mean, there's certainly, there's the short form content is very, very popular. I mean, I work in subscription video on demand industry myself, and I can confirm that short form content is popular, and it's popular with the kids. In fact, it's popular with all demos, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't think the message is we want football matches to be shorter. The message might be that we will probably only pay attention to football matches towards the climax of the game, but we might be doing something else while we're watching a football match, which is not something that's restricted to the young people. I can assure you middle-aged podcasters are exactly like that as well. I think that's a superficial reading of market behaviours and customer behaviour. If you want to be like commercial guy and think about football in strictly commercial terms, you need to know what you're talking about. And that is not the case. I mean, if it was just a bumbling old man who was a football club owner who was saying something like that, then I'd understand. But it's, oh, hang on a minute. It is, isn't it? Yeah. So, well, there you go, you see. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think we can take any of that too seriously. I think, obviously, you should always keep an eye on market trends. If you're in the business of entertaining people and providing these things, of course you should. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with taking a look in which the manner in which you present your sport and thinking, well, you know, maybe we could tweak it and adjust it. And that doesn't mean doing anything like changing the sport to any kind of meaningful level for the sake of it, because it's perfectly formed as it is. I don't think there's any desire for it whatsoever. If there's a slight desire for people to sort of like be able to chat with their mates, watch a game on Twitch, play along FIFA while they're doing it, or any kind of combination of that kind of activity, then that's absolutely fine. It doesn't mean you have to change football. There's no reason why you can't do that, or you can just like then sort off to your local non-league club and watch a game there with a few beers. Nobody sits and watches football just like glued at it unless you're an analyst. No one sits and watches football matches like laser focused unless they're stupidly engaged in it. You know, unless you're like, maybe if you're a fan, yes, but if it's a big game, maybe. But most of the time, people graze football. This is not controversial.
Especially when football is a TV show. Well, that's what it has been for the last 12 months, especially here without fans. Of course, we've had fans coming in over the weekend, which has been brilliant and adds a much different feel to the game. But if football was just a TV show, then yes, it probably would have to adapt because TV shows get cancelled. That's the nature of it. They last a few seasons and then we'll find something else that we want to watch. Football has survived this long without it. It's seen people grow up watching the game. And I remember my dad complaining because I couldn't sit down and watch a game because I'd be really excited about a game, but I'd just get overstimulated and I'd have to like walk around the house or like shout over to the next door neighbour or something like that about the goals that are going in. And that was the way I consumed football when I was a kid, even with the rare opportunities of seeing live games because they weren't that common. They'd usually be on in the summer for World Cups and things like that. So of course you wanted to go outside and play football as well at the same time as the game that was on the telly.
Well, we were at Whiteleaf, Graham. Of course we watched the game, but we were drinking beer and we're enjoying out each other's company. We're having a laugh, we're having a chat. This is life, Graham. It's life.
Of course. Of course it is. Football is part of life and it should be embraced as such. And yes, and if you're concentrating on a dire 0-0 draw and not taking your eyes off it, then really you're just watching football too hard. Dial back, enjoy it. That's what it's meant to be.
No, unless someone's paying you to do it, then yeah, definitely. You don't need to engage that much.
I suppose that's another aspect of it as well, though, is that there has been a lot of things said over the last week about how football should be from people who watch the game. And there's been perhaps less of it by people who actually earn their money from the game. Do you think that the players' interests or the people who work for football clubs, their interests haven't been assessed as much as, say, the fans have over the last week?
No, the narrative has very firmly been about fans, hasn't it? It's all been all about, you know, that football is nothing without fans, and that's been the message that's been coming through. But the odd thing about the Super League is that, one, it actually, ironically, in a perverse way, it was intended for the benefit of fans. Well, at least on the output wise anyway. In fact, the principle of cutting off effectively promotion and relegation into the what would be club football's top tier would actually have a greater effect on the players and coaching staff and the professionals, the sportsmen and women who have dedicated their careers to playing competitive football. Because it's something that's very, very relevant to them. It's the idea of saying, well, look, if you don't play for a European Super League club, you will never be able to play in club football's top tier. The only way you're going to be able to go up that way is if by getting a transfer. Now, of course, to a very large degree, very meaningful degree, that is also the case. But you can still dream of the idea of playing for a mid-table football club in the Premier League and think that if you have a really great season and you work hard, you might just be able to sneak into one of those European places. You might actually be able to make it happen. You might better do a Leicester or something like that, even though Leicester actually spent an awful lot of money to win the title. But you know where I'm coming from. It was only really when things started to fall apart was when the players started to go public about how they were against it. And I don't blame them for that at all. I don't blame them for waiting until the wind had changed and it was clear things were going in a particular direction and they had the momentum because, you know, their contracts are at stake, their livelihoods are at stake, these are their employers. You don't want to start going against the people who are paying your wages publicly unless you're very, very sure that you're doing the right thing. But it became very clear that a large number of players were not happy with this arrangement at all. I think you're right, Graham. I don't think that that's necessarily been considered. I think it's been mostly about how it affects the fans.
And as fans, it's quite right that we do get our say on this and about how we feel about it because it is our game. But, you know, if it didn't happen, then it's not as if we'd be chucked out of our houses, would we?
No, exactly. You've got to be able to find the right balance in these things. Yes, certainly it's fans that ultimately pay for this sport. It wouldn't work without a significant audience and fan base, whether that be people who turn up and pay to go into the stadiums or whether that be people who pay subscriptions to watch it on the television. And of course, they should have a significant say in any kind of changes that happen. But yeah, you're right, Graham. Ultimately, you know, you have to also think about the workers in all of this. And for sure, not just the playing staff as well. And not just the people on the sporting staff, but also in the other areas of football clubs as well, which may or may not be affected in ways that I can't really think of at the moment. But I'm sure that there would be significant upheaval to any football club that was to make this kind of move. And I don't imagine anybody there was consulted before this was decided or and then undecided.
Right. OK, so I think what we all need to do now is perhaps look at the near future. Then just crack on with the Europa Conference League stuff.
Maybe we should give the Conference League a miss until next week. What do you think?
Are you sure?
I think the Conference League maybe deserves a full episode. Yeah, I mean, that was what the arrangement is. And also, Bilton's not here. Like,
he did a load of work on that, didn't he?
He did a lot of work.
He made all those charts, didn't he? Coloured them all in, didn't he? So
yeah, he did, yeah. And it would be a shame, you know, to not get the benefit of that. We'd love to show those charts to the listeners. So, yeah. I mean, maybe we could just, like, wait, could defer it a week?
Well, okay. 1 week. Well, right. Definitely next week.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah,
definitely next week. Definitely Conference League chat, massive week. Conference League special.
Okay.
We're all bringing our Conference League glasses with us. Listeners, make sure you're wearing your Conference League glasses.
Yeah, and if you want to get some Conference League glasses, you can order them from us.
Somehow.
Well. So there was lots of protests at the weekend, though, wasn't there? Lots of fireworks going off outside the Emirates. It's all fun and games, but it's dying down now, isn't it? And I think the clamour for punishment will equally calm down as people get used to the idea that everything's actually going to be exactly the same as it was last season. And to be fair, I mean, the season is petering out now, isn't it? The prizes are start to be given out. The leagues are beginning to win. Teams are beginning to go down. Soon we'll have a bit of a break from club football. We'll be all consumed by the Euros. Then we'll all come back and it'll all seem like a distant memory, won't it? Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that the way of looking at, I think, from the dirty half dozen in England, they can at least draw some relief from the fact that, you know, we'll be focusing on the business end of the season. And then, yeah, as you say, Graham, will be a break. And then club football will act as a very nice palate cleanser, I think. And then not only that, but the season will return. And assuming that everything is all right over here, then, you know, there'll be fans back in the stadium when the Premier League and when the Football League kicks off again, and indeed when non-league kicks off again. And that will then add an extra dimension to the whole experience, and it will feel like things have got returned to normal. And if they're lucky, they might be able to get away with it by saying, yeah, it was all part of some kind of COVID-related fever dream, and that we can just move on from it now and let's never speak of it again. But we should speak of it again, and we should speak of it often, and we can't let these tow rags get away with that. And the moment they come anywhere near power, the moment they have any kind of idea as to whether or not the changes, they should just be showed. So, look, you're not part of this discussion. They should be shunned. They should not be invited to parties. They should not be allowed to participate in anything remotely meaningful. They should just turn up and look pretty from now on.
Yes, well, Man United and Liverpool will be showing up and looking pretty on Sky's top slot this weekend as they face each other on Super Sunday. I'm looking forward to that one, aren't you, Terry?
No, not really. Yes, Graham, I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yes, and that headlines our weekend box set this weekend, because we can't live without these people, can we? It's there. This is their biggest game. This is their biggest game of the season, isn't it? Any game that's on beforehand, what's the game on before? Oh, it's Arsenal again, of course. Newcastle against Arsenal is the one that precedes it. All the post-match analysis for that game will be on the red button, I guarantee you, because as soon as that game's over...
Yeah, it'll be on Sky Sports News.
Yeah. It will be, because as soon as that game's over, that's it. Gone.
Man United v Liverpool is the English derby, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it is comfortably the big one. It's one of the biggest games in the world. And so, yeah, of course, you are going to do that. And this ultimately is why the clamour for sanction will not probably reach the editorial offices of Sky Sports, because they don't want to go too far with this, because they also have to know which side their bread is buttered on. And they rely on Manchester United and Liverpool's goodwill in order to create the content that they need. And it is a symbiotic relationship, and I'm sure the feeling is mutual afterwards. There may be the equivalent of two old mates going down a pub, having a few drinks. First of all, they're a bit standoffish because it's been a while and there's been some beef between them. But eventually, you know, they loosen up, they have a bit of a fight, they slag each other off, they abuse each other, and then they walk home with each other, they're best mates, and all is forgiven. And I suspect it will be a bit like that. But anyway, sorry, returning to your box set thing.
Well, yeah, if the idea of Man United Liverpool isn't your cup of tea still, Sunday also offers the second leg of the Women's Champions League semi-final between Chelsea and Bayern Munich. And later, of course, on Sunday, we've got Monaco versus Lyon in the boring old Farmers League that is Ligue 1.
Yes, and I watched Lyon versus Lille last night, and it was an absolute cracker. It was the perfect way to end what's been an absolutely ridiculous week of football with a fantastic game of football.
Not only that, but it had more goals in that one game than there was in the rest of the other half dozen in the box set. Sorry, listeners, but yeah, we picked a load of turkeys last weekend. Hopefully this weekend will be a lot better. And if you want to see what we put in this weekend's box set, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set and sign up for it. Otherwise, you can just come back and read it on the blog. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, and from Terry DeFello, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
Oh, God.